Okay. You can start right out.
Okay. Now, we could do 10 hours on the economy because that is what it's all about anyway. And I have a whole manila folder filled with articles. One of them, just to read the subject titles of those articles, is by Cyrus Eaton called The President as the Dictator. And just briefly, what he says to an effect, quote, is, to one who has survived all the financial panics of this century and has known all the presidents and been privileged to participate in building up American industry and agriculture, the disgrace of the dollar in world financial centers is sobering. In effect, we have a presidential dictatorship sustained by the greatest propaganda machine in history, nationwide primetime television. The president ignores the Congress. He rarely consults his cabinet. He bypasses the United Nations. He announces his decisions over the air to the unsophisticated. The president has determined our disastrous financial policies and international relationships, and is commander-in-chief of the armed forces, a position of power strangely out of place in a democracy, especially in this nuclear age. He carries on illegal foreign wars with the aid of thousands of spies in all nations. Three Wall Street lawyers, Nixon, Mitchell, and Rogers, are spending the taxpayers' money around the world like drunken soldiers. Future historians may use such epithets as dictator and demagogue to describe the president. Philosophers assess his intellectual depth in terms of his association with Billy Graham. But Mr. Nixon accepts the impression that he is helping this country, and he lends himself to distributing what he knows by the television. This was in the New York Times, August the 31st, 1971. The New York Times, in September the 12th, 1971, had this article by Russell Baker on the economy and what President Nixon was doing. He said, the public, the press, and influential politicians of both parties have generally approved the president's new economic policy. And yet, these moments of hearty public applause for dynamic presidential actions are always a little scary. The Gulf Tonkin Resolution, which absentmindedly empowered presidents to fight their heart's content in Asia, passed the House of Representatives by a vote of 416-0, and the Senate by 88-2. And when everybody agrees with you, watch out. Now as then, the Congress, with the Democrats leading them, handed the presidency a grant of power that seems likely to strengthen that office's tendency to become an autocracy. The justification for these is what the president calls a national emergency, and it is foolish to quarrel with the president's national emergency just because there are no bombs falling or stock markets collapsing. The natural tendency is to take refuge in one's own ignorance and laugh about the dullness of the subject and let the experts have their way and give the president more power. For the past several years, we've told the Congress that it could have sweeping power to grant to its presidents. And now it turns out, as many of us awoke to discover the event, that Congress has no more power at all. Here was a president assuming powers of economic regulation by decree, similar to the power exercised in totalitarian states that we have been resisting for 30 years or more, frequently with blood. The power to do so was given to him in advance by Congress, with a proviso that he first find a national emergency to justify himself. American business and labor may have to get used to the idea, said Secretary of Treasury John Connally, of living within certain parameters. Mr. Connally is a protege of Lyndon Johnson, and he is mentioned as a potential vice president candidate on the next Republican ticket. Now, as a research, end quotes, New York Times, September the 12th, 1971. As a researcher on political assassinations, I know that we gave Lyndon Johnson the power, under the excuse of national emergency, to conduct a Warren Commission, to turn over the evidence and handle what he wanted to see, to not show you what he didn't want to show you. The Congress gave total power. They didn't question the Warren Report. If the vote of the Gulf of Tonkin was 16-0, the same thing would happen with a vote of confidence in the Warren Commission report. The Senate would give him the same 88-2, the total vote of confidence, and yet I have about 17 articles on the police state policy that Lyndon Johnson had and that is taken over by Richard Nixon, and it is going into your economy, and this is where people are beginning to listen now to what I'm saying, because the economy is what hurts. The murder of John Kennedy didn't hurt. Now, remember the lawsuit that we mentioned in Los Angeles there's a suit that is filed against the Los Angeles Police Department by Theodore Sharrock, Superior Court of the State of California for the County of Los Angeles, suit 978371, complaint for the disclosure of information on government code 54950, Theodore Sharrock, on behalf of himself and all other residents of the State of California, plaintiff versus the Los Angeles Police Department, Edward Davis, the chief of police, and the individual policeman Robert Houghton, chief of the police department, deputy chief of police in Los Angeles at the time Robert Kennedy was killed, Evel Younger, who was district attorney at the time of the Robert Kennedy murder, who is now the attorney general of the State of California. The case reads, the plaintiff alleges on behalf of himself and all other residents of the State of California that the people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to the agencies which serve them. The people, in delegating authority, do not give their public servants the right to decide what is good for the people to know and what is not good for them to know. The people insist on remaining informed so they may retain control over the instruments they have created.
This is what we originally started out with, the right to know.
The right. Well, this is a lawsuit, and everyone who's listening to me, if you live in the State of California, you are part of a lawsuit on the right to know. And in the statement of this economic problem and a police state, it not only is a problem with the dollar at home and in Europe, but what Richard Nixon is doing with John Connally is tightening up the reins. It is interesting that the criticisms that are coming in are not only economic, but they are political. The words I have read to these people are political statements. They're not economic things. They're on the control of power. Now, Evans and Novak, two writers, in February 15, 1971, had an article on tax reform in the United States, which read as follows. Presidential aides, afraid of a tax reform during a presidential election year, thought of the idea of having a presidential commission to draft the reform. In this way, they would get Congress and the country to approve. To appease the people, they used this approach. They appointed a commission headed by Roy Ash, this is from Litton Industries, for sweeping reorganization program. They would refer to it as Mr. Nixon's American Revolution. It would become tax reform next year. If the Ash-type commission, working under presidential guidelines, put its prestige on reform, it may stand a backing and a better chance, because they would say it was a prestigious commission and it would enhance Mr. Nixon's chance of another reform issue for the country for his reelection campaign. Any tax reform that he would put on ahead of time would be argued by Chairman Mills, who would attack the scheme by saying that it shifts the burden from big corporations to the little taxpayer. By having a commission, it's end the quote now from February 15th, 1971. I tend to run what I'm reading as against my opinion, and the show I get kind of excited. So I'm going to say that is the quotation from the newspaper, February the 15th, 1971. This is September. In February, researchers and writers in the East Coast got wind that by having what they called a commission, there would be prestige. The president could put over something he could never do otherwise, and he might be noticed. So who designed that? Roy Ash of Litton Industries. Should we do on my David contest the connection of Roy Ash, and I've talked about him on other shows, helping with the Litton industry? This is the group that is rewriting the new cabinet for the United States. By 72, I could read a whole evening on the new Constitution that has been suggested for the United States, where the senators are no longer elected at large. They will be appointed by retired Army officials. There will be no more justice, no more Supreme Court. That will be done away with. Mr. Ashe sits on those committees. Mr. Ashe, Roy Ashe, was the man who told President Nixon to have John Conley as the Secretary of Treasury. He put John Conley in this condition. He rewrites our tax reforms. He's revising our cabinet. I have a newspaper article I brought in from the Washington Post on the revision of the cabinet. Nixon plans to revise the cabinet. Above everything would be the president, and below that are four departments. The Department of State, that's Mr. Rogers and Kissinger. The second department would be the Treasury, Mr. Connolly. The third department would be Defense, the Pentagon and military, and the fourth department would be the Department of Justice, John Mitchell. Now, the branches of the cabinets that would be abolished completely would be the Department of Interior, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Commerce, Department of Health, Education, and Labor, the Department of Welfare and Housing, the Department of Urban Development and Transportation.
Where would those come, May?
They would be those four. These four large departments would be established, and everything else would come under them. The Department of State, Treasury, Defense, and Justice, I'm reading the article, would be the only ones unaffected by the reorganization. John Conley said that Roy Ashe, I'm reading the newspaper article that I have here, John Conley said that Roy Ashe, president of Litton Industries and chairman of the commission that recommends the changes, estimated an eventual saving of $5 billion a year. Now, the American people may feel out of sight we've saved $5 billion. But next week, do you want me to spend 1 hour or some hour during the week, spend 60 minutes of reading, just listing off, like we listed problems today, a billion, 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 million, million being wasted by the government on one submarine, one airplane, three dune buggies on the moon? He's going to save you, he says, $5 billion. But do you know how many billion we've wasted? And we would be doing away with any controls. Now, if you do research like I do into the Litton industry that has been documented in helping overthrow the Greek government and build a military junta, you can parallel our government to what's happening to Greece. And you take this department, you do away with land and recreation, water resources, energy and mineral resources, marine atmosphere and terrestrial resources and technology, Indian territories. All of those are eliminated. You eliminate health services, income, maintenance, security, education, manpower, social and rehabilitation services. You do away with food and commodities, domestic and international commerce, science and technology, labor relations and standards, national transportation systems. What I say you do, well, you have no checks or balances, you know, have no cabinet members. And you do with urban and rural development, housing, highways, federal high-risk insurance programs, social and economic information. So what we're talking about is that in order to understand the total police state that we're in, you have to understand how Richard Nixon came to power. You have to understand what's going on in Los Angeles in the Sirhan case. You have to understand why the presidents won't go into the murder of John Kennedy. And these are why all of the things that I'm mentioning are political. They're related to political assassinations. And for new people who saw the TV show or heard me on KIDD, I've tried today to go through just a list of some of the problems that in 1 hour a week that you have felt or known about or that you can read about in your paper. And I'm going to try as long as I can to take some of them.
And I see that there's two more here that we didn't touch on.
Oh yes.
Nixon's Supreme Court choices.
Oh, yeah. Richard Nixon just has the hardest decision of his whole life to select a justice of the Supreme Court because the assassination teams work in the South and the Southwest. And if he appoints another Carswell or Haynesworth, he's going to have another disgrace. If he takes a racist, if he takes a man who's connected with racist clubs or whose decisions were not appropriate to the times that are a-changing, he's not going to be able to get it through because everybody's watching. And if he doesn't select somebody that suits their needs in the South, because everything, the decision to change the Constitution to do away with the Senate or to change the cabinet, these decisions may come up before the Supreme Court at some time. And if he chooses somebody that is moderate, Richard Nixon, again, he could be killed. We've talked about this before. If the balance of power of his life, I think, hangs, if I could do a diagram or a mobile, on the selection, if he takes a really far-out lawyer, a scholarly kind of person who would give a fair shake, there are certain people who are going to say, Dick, this isn't what we put you in for. You've always been a front man. This isn't what you're here for. And you better get on with it. And if he puts himself in a third position where he gets embarrassed and disgraced, then what's he going to do? I really don't know how this man is going to make a decision to please two factions, because we do have in this country, people aren't aware of it, we have a civil war. We have a war going on. It's going to get to the streets. People know it. But there is a very sinister war going on, factions now, the kind that kills the Kennedys and Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, and they wouldn't hesitate with Richard Nixon. Because we said over and again, the name of the game is power. And what is Nixon going to do? I should think he'd give somebody else the job of selecting. I can't imagine how he's going to make this decision, knowing the rules of the game.
Then I think you have an article with you from Computers and Automation about Lee Harvey Oswald. Is that right?
Oh, yes, because, again, we take the news of the weekend. Since I came home last Saturday, a new article, the September 1971 issue of Computers and Automation. And for people who heard the other shows and are new to listening, this magazine, the address is 815 Washington Street, Newtonville, Massachusetts, 02160. And for 1 year, if you subscribe, it's $9.50 a year. And if you would send them money for the past issues from May 1970 until 1971, you would have in your library an invaluable collection for lawyers. I was with a lawyer last night going over articles in this thing that she didn't even know existed, cases that are pending, legal cases regarding political assassinations. And they have covered photographic evidence of the John Kennedy assassination and evidence of the Martin Luther King, the conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King and cover it up. And every month, the Computers and Automation is being fed information in Washington and in Massachusetts on the political assassinations in the United States, and including the Black Panthers, the pattern of killing the Panthers. So the issue that came this week is called The Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Assassination of John Kennedy. And the article is written by Bernard Fensterwald in Washington, and the article is 1 to 3.5 pages long, magazine size, like Newsweek or Time magazine. It's 3.5 pages long, and it has one page of document evidence to back up the author's statements. He has 47 footnotes to three pages. Now, people say to me as a researcher, how do you know what to read? How do you know what's true? How do you know what's false? And I say, stick with the people who are putting the footnotes, the volume number and page number. This is one reason it's taken me so long to complete my research before I started in to write one book, which I'm writing now, is that I didn't want anybody to come to me. And if I made one sentence, like Oswald was an agent of the FBI, they'd say, how did you know it? And I'd say, oh, in those books, if you just read it, you'll see it. If I say he's an agent of the FBI and I give 12 reasons, those 12 reasons will have a volume number and page number. So this article tells all the many instances of Oswald's association with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and then it has footnotes which read like WR means Warren Report, or CE are commission exhibits which were published and sold by the government printing library, and they're $76, or CD means commissioned document which has since been released from the National Archives and being declassified. Now, this is what I work with, the Warren Report, WR, or the CE exhibits, or the CD commission documents. That's the way my research works, and this is all they work. And it goes into the fact that the only person that investigated the Warren Commission for the field work was the FBI, and the FBI was suspect for Oswald being an agent, and he goes into the first meeting of the Warren Commission, where Wagoner Carr, I'm reading from Computers and Automation, that Texas Attorney General Wagoner Carr, based on information supplied to him by Dalek District Attorney and former FBI agent Henry A. Wade and others, informed the Warren Commission in January 1964 that there was evidence that Oswald was an FBI informant. The information occasioned an emergency meeting of the Warren Commission, January the 22nd, 1964. The stenographic record of this meeting was confiscated and never written up. Carr and Wade were among those invited to Washington to discuss the allegation with the commission. The meeting was held in total secrecy on January the 24th. Even the stenographic reporters were excluded. The proceedings have never been published. Gerald Ford, a member of the Warren Commission, wrote about this in his book. And quotes from Computer and Automation. We go back to the suit in Los Angeles, which says the people of this state do not yield their sovereignty to these agencies. Now, I went to a lawyer in Carmel about a year and a half ago and wanted to place a citizen's arrest against J. Edgar Hoover based on the information that Oswald was an employee of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and I was told that nobody in Washington would serve it. And what law? There must be lawyers in the area or some lawyer someday who's going to pick this up and file this suit for me as a citizen. Because what law protects these officials? Or, as the suit reads, are we in control over the instruments that we have created? J. Edgar Hoover is in a position to protect me. He's not in a position to keep from us the names of the people who killed the president. I could read more if we have time, Gloria, of the Oswald, the agent of the FBI.
Yeah, we have about a little over 5 minutes.
Oh, somebody asked me on one of the shows, on the talk show, and it was a very good question, was Oswald smart enough to be an agent of the FBI? And I love to talk just 1 hour on this kind of a show with the evidence of the material and talk about our daily news as it comes in, or weekly news. And then I love questions because you can go way out in the field and answer them and tie it together, and there's never enough time for both, you know. And people are confused because they've been given the image of Oswald as a boob, a kid who never did anything well, couldn't hold a job, didn't like his wife.
Well, you have mentioned this on past programs.
We have, and I think it bears repetition because the whole theme of the first book that I'm writing, I call it my first love. It's the one I got the most involved in and spent the most time and research on. The theme was that in the effect that if Oswald was not what the United States government said he was, like a ne'er-do-well and so forth, how are the minds of the people made to believe he was? How do you manipulate the news media and relate the evidence to this particular person to back up his real training in radar electronics and microdotting photographic techniques, his ability to get into the Soviet Union, to get all the State Department waivers passed, exclusion of every law in the book to bring his Russian wife home. I think it bears repetition, and you people should keep hearing it. And you should know that he had all the devices of an agent in his garage. He had cameras, pedometers, telescopes, electronic devices. He had applied for a passport in the spring of 63 in New Orleans to go back to the Soviet Union. I have a copy of a letter arranging for the birth of his second child to be done at a very expensive clinic. He was to send the money to Dallas, Texas ahead of time so his wife would have the baby there. When the Warren Report was written up, the excuse for her being in Dallas and not being with him was that he was out of a job and couldn't take care of himself, so Mrs. Payne, who hosted them, picked up Marina New Orleans and took her to Texas. But a month before Lee Oswald ever lost a job and was fully in play, they were corresponding about the next trip to Texas and where the baby would be born. So the evidence, I hope I'm not going too fast on that point. The Warren Report tells you that a certain party, a Mrs. Payne, housed Marina or transported her because she felt sorry for Marina Lee. He didn't have a job, and she took them back from New Orleans to Texas, where Marina lived at the home, and then she drove her to the hospital to have a baby, and Lee didn't really care about the child, and she puts down his personality, his fatherhood, and all other things. Whereas the commission exhibits show a correspondence between Ruth Payne and Marina Oswald making arrangements for the delivery of the baby months prior to the move and saying send a deposit, have Lee send a deposit of X amount of money because the delivery will cost several hundred dollars at this particular clinic. Well, they decided to go to Parkland Hospital and use the charity bit, which agents use because then it looks like they're down and out. But they did have the idea of using a very expensive clinic for the birth of that child. Where did that money come from? You see, it boils down to Oswald, the agent, always having money, but their cover story is to look poor, and that's the story that people believe is true. That is the untruth.
Well, that's what we could have talked about today.
That's what we could have talked about.
Yeah, we have about, I guess 4 or 5 minutes left. Did you want to touch on the death in San Jose?
Yes. I was going to do an entire show on a murder in San Jose.
Well, yes. This is current.
This is current.
They can get this out of their newspaper if they want to, if you just point out a few things.
Just yesterday morning's article on the front page says, thought victim had gun, small print, no weapon found on body. I read the article. A San Jose research chemist was coming home in early hours of the morning, and he had a traffic violation. A policeman followed him, saw him make an illegal turn, pulled up into the back of an apartment on 4221 Norwick Drive. The chemist, who works for IBM, got out of his car and spoke to the officer who was writing the ticket. Two off-duty officers came to see if the original policeman needed assistance, and they were told, no, it was all right. At which point, Mr. Smith, John Smith, became angry and pulled a tire iron out of his car and attempted to strike one of the off-duty officers. Using chemical mace, he was subdued. And as he ran towards the apartment building, he was shot and killed. This morning's paper has another article. San Jose chief backs the officer in the shooting. Now, the chief of police in San Jose is saying the officer was right, even though it was a traffic violation. He is going to support the death of John Smith. Now, John Smith was not only a chemist at IBM, he was a black man. And he was hired by IBM in 1965 as a lab specialist and a graduate of Langston University. He had a scholarship at graduate at Las Vegas, New Mexico. He was a high school and college honor student. Now, what was he doing? At 4:15 in the morning, he went to the back of an apartment, and the policeman followed up and said, you went through a traffic light. As he gets out of his car, this research chemist, graduate student, black, sees another car pull up where two off-duty men, not in uniform, pull up behind. Now, you get a different picture. A black man, 4:15 in the morning, in an alley, three men confronting him, two not knowing their cops, just in everyday street clothes, saying to the officer, do you need some help? And when the man got angry, the three pulled mace in his face. And then when he got sufficiently angry at the mace, the article this morning says they let go police dogs. Woolley came up twice, the policeman, and sprayed him with chemical mace. And when they told him to put his hands on the car and he broke away, they sent a police dog after him. Now, he may have just been reaching for a handkerchief to wipe his eyes from the mace. He went to the back of the apartment and was going to enter. Woolley fired one time, hit him in the chest, and he died moments later. Now, the San Jose chief of police says, my officers were right. They have to defend themselves. This chemist, this boy, had no weapon. Now, we talk about civil rights and blacks getting educations or opportunities. John Smith's mother is a maid in Oklahoma. His father is a chauffeur and maintenance man. This boy worked his way up. His dad's a waiter and a chauffeur. His mother's a maid. The boy got an education in the American system. He got a scholarship. He got all the way to the IBM office in San Jose, and he shot down and maced and bitten by police dogs. And the day after that happened, the police officer says, my man was right in shooting him. I could do a whole show on the political implications of why I think he was killed. Not only political, not because he was a Panther, but because I know how IBM operates, and I could do a show on that.
Well, maybe we can bring this one up again.
It's very important.
Another show. I'm sorry we're out of time.
Yeah.
Thank you again.
You've been listening to Dialogue. Dialogue is a presentation of the Public Affairs and Special Events Department.